also, according to Eugene Vedic, which is the last in Asia, which speaks about this in Bhagavad Gita, the mind can also be considered a sense, in that your mind feels things. You've all had an experience of feeling something in your mind, turning over in your mind, and then willing action, acting appropriately, feel thought in your mind. So happiness is perceived by the senses. So, whatever and whomever you're in contact with, whether it's a job, or a car, or clothes, or a relationship, those things, those persons have to justify themselves to your senses. Your senses are the standard for judging whether your life is successful or not. If your senses are feeling appropriately stimulated, then you feel like you're a successful person. You can hold your head up high. Or not high, but at least you can hold your head up. Yes, things are all right. My senses do experience gratification in this relationship. My senses do experience some stimulation in this situation. Or I'm getting things for my senses from this job. And that way, you feel like your life is efficient. We can see more and more that people view themselves to be like happiness factories. Your life has to produce enough happiness. Otherwise, you feel like you're a failure and then you become depressed. Now, no one expects to be happy all the time. But you do expect your personal happiness factory to turn out enough of a product to make life worthwhile. And once again, you're always ready to make the necessary changes in case something doesn't turn out the way you thought it would turn out. And that's the basic bottom line for you to evaluate all the situations. Is this making me happy or not? This justifies everything, this principle. Whether it's a long-standing relationship or anything. If it's not working right now, and it looks like it hasn't worked for a while, you've got to cut it out. Because it's your life, and your life is your chance for accumulating happiness. Everyone has that mission. Everyone can understand. So this is the cultural inheritance that you receive from the preceding generation, and this is the cultural inheritance that you'll pass on to the coming generation. This is how today's parents raise their children, and this will therefore be how tomorrow's parents raise their children. You know, you just gotta do what you gotta do, you know? Whatever makes you happy. Just follow your dream. So basically what you have is a short span of time. You have a limited amount of time for your life. And in that limited amount of time, you're trying for happiness. You're pursuing happiness. You're playing your own version of beat the clock. I've got X amount of years. And during those X amount of years, I've got to be happy some of the time. Now, in order to maintain your focus, you can't look around at those who are more happy than you too often. Every once in a while, you take a glimpse of those who you think might be more happy than you. And then you dismiss them. They're more happy, but it's not for real. Because they're more happy than me. It can't be for real. Anyway, if they've got more than me, they're materialists. I have just what I need to live a basic life. No more than any human being. those other people with more than me, they are the materialists. They're greedy. So, they don't count. Then you take a look at those who have less than you, from your point of view. And you look at them, and then you can actually become happy. I've got a lot to be happy for. I've got good looks. I've got good education. I've got more money than these other persons. You start to feel better. But every once in a while, your eyes stray to those who apparently have more. They look better. They have a better relationship, a better partner than you. A flashier car, more money, better house. And you get a little rattled. And then you turn on a bit of a TV, watch some TV, and even though you say, oh, I know television, it's just all a make-believe world, but you get it affected. Just look at this. Your subconscious mind is telling you, just look at this. You can't help but be imprinted in that way. You're watching it all the time, and gradually it builds up in your subconsciousness. Maybe I'm one of the friends. Maybe I'm one of the Sopranos. In this way, you become very molded in your understanding of what you think happiness is. So we have so many people today who have this burden that I've got to acquire it. I've got to discover it in me, my happiness. Something that actually should be so simple is now such a complicated, intricate thing. Just like so many of you have computers. And no doubt most of you don't understand computers completely, so when the inevitable happens and there's some kind of computer malfunction, you have to call a specialist to handle the complication. So, happiness has become like computers these days. The situations have become so intricate and complex. What am I going to do to be happy? Oh, I need some kind of therapy. I need some kind of guidance, some kind of counseling. The simplest things have become so complicated. Becoming happy has become a consumer product. I've got to acquire it. Do I have enough left on my credit card that I can buy happiness? And we're quite sure it exists. There's some people who are happy, so I can be happy too. If you've ever traveled, for example, in the traditional village areas of India, you'd be shocked to see that people have practically nothing compared to other places. Yet they look so much more content. How can that be? It causes you to think. And beyond whatever your perceptions are, if you've traveled around, let's give you some statistics. Recently, the UN did a survey on levels of happiness throughout the world. Guess which country turned out to be the happiest country, the happiest people, according to the UN survey. Bangladesh, the poorest country in the world. How do you figure that? How is it possible that the poorest country in the world, according to the UN survey, is the happiest? The country where people have the least, they're the happiest. How can that be? This ought to make an intelligent person think very deeply. But I found that many persons, they mentally dismiss this UN survey saying, well, yeah, I mean, because these people in Bangladesh or countries like that, they have limited expectations. They actually don't know what happiness is. They don't know what they're missing. Therefore, they came out to be the happiest country. Yeah, that must be it. After all, I mean, look, there's got to be some real happiness in this rat race. Otherwise, why is everyone doing it? Why is everyone struggling so hard in the race for happiness, the pursuit of happiness? There's no happiness there. It's all right. The survey showed that those with the least, the poorest country in the world, the happiest. But maybe it's right. But people dismiss it. It's just too revolutionary for them. How it is that the poorest country in the world is the happiest. But if you allow yourself to be challenged, if you allow yourself to think about that, it can cause a revolution in your life. Now, the ancient Vedic knowledge of India that we study here has something very interesting to say about happiness. And it will once again challenge your conceptions. This knowledge I'm about to relate to you was spoken by a 5-year-old boy. Normally, you don't listen very seriously to 5-year-olds. People like when children try to say something meaningful. You get a kick out of it, but you don't take it so seriously. But this 5-year-old was very unusual. His name was Prahlad Maharaj. He had very deep knowledge, which he had acquired in a very unique place. This is even the text of Śrīmad-Bhāgavatam. They have that. This is the graduate study of the Bhagavad Gita. They have that. Bhagavad Gita means the song of the most opulent one. And then the graduate study of the Bhagavad Gita, Śrīmad-Bhāgavatam, that title means the all auspicious, most beautiful presentation of the science of the Supreme. So I'm giving you information from Śrīmad-Bhāgavatam. This 5-year-old boy, Prahlad, was such a deep philosopher, such a deep student of life, master of life. How did he get his knowledge? While he was within the womb of his mother before he was born. His mother heard lessons of extraordinary spiritual knowledge, Krishna conscious knowledge, being given by a wandering teacher named Narada Muni. So, the mother was listening, but she couldn't remember because she was in a lot of anxiety about her family. Her husband was away from home, so she was thinking about that. And even though she heard, she didn't remember. You might have had that experience that when there's anxiety in your mind, you can't retain or remember things. But when your mind is peaceful and calm, it's like if you lose your house key in a shallow pond of water. If you just wait for the water to become still, you're able to stare to the bottom. See your key, but while the water is swirling around, you can't see. So similarly, if your mind is disturbed, it's very hard to remember to liberate properly. So Prahlad's mother had a disturbed mind, even though she heard what this traveling son, this traveling saint, teacher, she heard his lessons, but she couldn't remember. Prahlad, however, while in the womb of his mother, while she was pregnant, he heard and he assimilated all the knowledge, this information from Śrīmad-Bhāgavatam shows you that yes, there is children can have that special ability to assimilate knowledge even while they're in the womb of their mother. It can happen. Prahlad was no ordinary child. He heard these lessons very clearly while he was with his mother. And so he developed very rapidly in terms of his higher consciousness, here's my consciousness. So when he was 5 years old and he was sent to school, and he was sent to a specialist school for becoming a hardcore materialist, because that's where his father was at. His father's name in Sanskrit was Hiranyakashipu. His father had a name that lets you know where he was at. Haranya means gold, Kashipu means soft bed. So that's where his father was at. Money, money, and the pleasures of the couch. So his father was completely full-on dedicated to greedy materialist. But his son was completely different. Nevertheless, his father, not taking into account that it would never be possible for a spiritually inclined person to take birth in his family, the father sent the boy at the age of 5 to a specialist school for training future hardcore materialists, learning things like how to divide and conquer, manipulate, control people by pandering to their material desires, like that. Follow the leader, essential skills. And I want my son to follow in my footsteps. So he should learn these sacred arts from the age of 5 years old. So the boy dutifully went to school, but whenever the lunch break came, he gathered all his little friends around him, and he began to speak spiritual knowledge, Krishna conscious knowledge, at the age of 5. One of the major things he told them was this revolutionary principle, which you may find difficult to grasp at first. He said that the happiness perceived in relation between the senses and the sense object. You see, your body is a bag of senses. Please get into the habit of this. Whenever you talk about your body, you're speaking about your senses. The body is nothing more than a collection of senses. So, Prahlad Maharaj explained that happiness that's perceived in relation to the senses of the body in contact with sense objects. Sense objects are the nose wants to smell things, ears want to hear pleasing sounds, the tongue wants to taste things, the skin wants to touch nice things to it. They're all sense objects. So that happiness, which is perceived in the connection between the senses and the sense objects, you can get that, Prahlad said, any species of life. It actually tastes the same flavor. It's very revolutionary information. In other words, the flavors that human beings today are so passionately pursuing, these flavors are available in any species of life. That means the cats, the dogs, the birds, the bees. They also have senses, you know. And through their sensual activities, they get the same taste that the human beings get. Without going through all the anxieties, you don't have to go to counselors. You don't have to go to therapists. It's just natural. So Prahlad, the 5-year-old boy, is pointing out to his friends, even though they're just 5 years old, he tells them, start understanding this now. The sooner the better, the earlier the better. Don't think, oh, we're too young, we just want to play. When we're old and gray, then we'll become more spiritual. No, Prahlad says, at 5 years old, this is the great time to understand these points. Why should you struggle so hard to please your senses when the flavor that you're getting through such struggle is the same thing that the animals are getting without all that struggle? The flavor is the same. All right, the activities are packaged differently. Still, the flavor is the same. This point would cause an health burden. Why am I working so hard? Or why am I going through so much anxiety? So much complication just to get the same flavor that an animal can get without all this elaborate ritual and stress and strain. I was watching an animal about tigers and what happens. Well, the tigers are the food for romance. The female tiger, she doesn't have to go and spend a lot of money on clothes and cosmetics. She doesn't have to read books on how to get just right. She doesn't have to do any of those things. She doesn't have to go to a hair, get her hair done. Nothing. Nature makes it all so easy. What does the female tiger do? She can release a particular fragrance that goes kilometers in every direction. And any male tiger, 3 kilometers away, he knows. It's party time. That's how simple it is. No complications. No, you know. So, the male tiger comes. He doesn't have to get on the internet, you know, and you know, find a suitable match, you know. And first, you have to go into a chat room on the internet. You know, and then work up enough nerve to actually meet the person. Ah. It smells that fragrance 3 kilometers away. He knows. So, the male tiger finds the particular female tiger, has that brand of perfume, and he approaches her. And what does she do? She growls at him and swats him in the face with her paw, and then the male tiger goes off, you know. He comes back again. She does the same thing. You know, he's not going to give in easily, you know. I mean, he's got to go through his, you know, he's got to pay the price. Third time, he goes away, and he comes back. And all of a sudden, this time she's completely different, making nice purring sounds in her throat. And then they cohabit. They become partners. And then, you know, she becomes pregnant. And what happens as soon as the little tigers are born? Like every good man, the father tiger just takes off. Oh, she'll get the benefit anyway. She'll get the dolls. So, what is so different about this from human beings? But humans go through such complications and anxieties. You get the same flavor. This is the point. Regardless of the intricacy of human life as compared to animal life, the flavor is the same that you're getting. I wonder how many of us will have that boldness to think the next time you're trying to enjoy your senses, actually I'm getting the same taste in the cat and dog. Think of that. That is a fact. And Pilate, at 5 years old, was able to point this out. The materialistic feeling of having a satisfied belly or refreshing yourself with some beverage or the pleasures of sensual stimulation is the same. The flavor is the same, although the packaging is different. So that makes an intelligent human being think. Why should I go through all this complication and struggle to get that same taste that the animals are getting? I should be meant for something better. Now, unfortunately, too many people are following the rule that when you want to judge your happiness, never compare yourself to anyone better than you. Always compare yourself to someone worse than you. So many people will say, so what if we're getting the same taste as the animals? Still, you know, we're better. So there's nothing so bad about getting the same taste as the animals. I mean, actually, we aren't just animals anyway. Huh? Because they do this because they don't know anyone better. Any better example. Now, besides pointing out that the flavor is the same in every species of life, the flavor of activity of enjoying the senses is the same, Prahlad Maharaj also pointed out that you're going to get whatever happiness you're supposed to get automatically, even if you don't try for it. This is difficult to understand. According to activities that you performed in your previous life, you have set up for yourself in this life a certain amount of happiness and a certain amount of distress, which is going to come to you regardless. In other words, this life is a done deal. You can't be one drop more happy than what you deserve based on your dharma from your past life. And you can't be one drop less miserable than what you are due from your past life. This is what the five-year-old boy is teaching this. So in other words, why try so hard for material happiness when you can't get any more than what you're due? What you're going to get, you're going to get. Now, people have a hard time understanding this because they say, okay, even if it's true that I had a previous life, even if it's true that there's karma and this life is a reaction to my previous life, still, I can see that I can make more money if I would just exert myself. Now, how can that be dharma? How can everything be predestined by karma? When I can choose right now to make $100 more a week by working 10 extra hours overtime, whatever, 5 extra hours overtime, that I can choose to do that or not. So how can you say that everything is based on my past life? No, we have to be a little more subtle in our understanding. The 5-year-old boy, Prahlad, is talking about the amount of happiness and distress. In other words, whether you make a lot of money or little money, that you might be able to alter. But you can't alter the amount of happiness in your life. Let's say, for example, you're suffering with a headache. If you take some aspirin and the headache goes away, does that mean you have altered the amount of distress in your life? Not according to the Vedic knowledge. Not according to what 5-year-old Prahlad knows. He understands that by your taking the aspirin, you haven't affected the sum total of distress due to you. You've just changed it. It'll come another way. You can't alter that amount of distress. You can block it. It'll come a different way, but still it will come. Similarly, you can't alter your happiness in terms of the amount. So therefore, an intelligent person will think, why should I struggle to pursue happiness when I'm going to get what I'm going to get anyway? What's the point in all this false labor for something I'm going to get anyway? And that was exactly Prahlad's point. Why struggle? You're going to get it anyway. Even if you do nothing, Now, granted, it is impossible for you to sit around and do nothing. As Lord Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, everyone is forced to act. They're pushed by what is called the modes of nature. They can't just sit around and do nothing. You have to do something. I'm sure you've tried it for a while, just to lay around and do nothing. In order to stay in that condition, even for a temporary amount of time, you had to really intoxicate yourself so you couldn't move. But how many days would that last before finally you just, I gotta do something? No. You can't just sit around and do nothing. But the fact is, even if you could, still you would get whatever happiness you do. No more, no less. Now, some people say, well, this kind of understanding would just need to be very fatalistic about your life. You wouldn't have that determination to push ahead. You just say, it's all going to happen according to my karma. But why is it that understanding all your happiness and distress is predestined? Why does that mean you're just going to lay around and be a lazy bum? Why not work hard for spiritual enlightenment? That is not determined by your karma. That's completely wide open. Up to you. But any material activity, your happiness and distress, those are material experiences. That's already decided for this lifetime. Now, you can affect the happiness and distress in your next life. So in other words, by your present activities, you are experiencing the karmic reactions from your past life. Simultaneously, you're generating new karmic reactions for yourself in the future. So every moment, you're experiencing the past and you're creating the future simultaneously. This is an important point to understand because people either go to one extreme or the other. They say, oh, everything is all predestined, it's all karma, no matter what you do. That's not completely true. Let me go to the other extreme. Your life is just an open slate. You have to choose. You have to do it. Have the right attitude. The future is in your hands. These both are extremes. At every moment, you are experiencing the shackles of the past. And you're creating the future. Both things are happening simultaneously. This present moment is made up of your karmic reactions from the past, and then you're making choices now which will affect your future life, your future happiness and distress. So the five-year-old boy Prahlad is telling his school friends, why waste your time with all this stuff? First of all, you're pursuing flavors that any species of life, the animals, for example, can get. The same taste. When you see dogs in the street cohabiting with their partner, you should know that the same flavor is what the human beings are getting after going through so many rituals, going to a restaurant, cafe, club. Sometimes, because we live right around here in the center, so I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning do our mantra meditation, so I can look out the window and see people coming from the clubs. And so again and again I see the same scene. You know, there's a group of guys and girls, and then they reach the corner, particularly an intersection, in which, you know, people separate and go their different ways from different parts of town. So each time I see every morning a case like this with. Obviously, some girls and guys they had met at the club, they didn't know each other before, and then they were drinking, and then it's 5 in the morning, and, you know, the guys are, you know, very eager to make the night a complete success. So they kind of pause at this corner, and the girls are making like, okay, you know, it was nice, and we'll see you, and And the guys are standing there like, come with us. And so the kind of like back and forth were a bit like that, you know. And then finally the girl just, you know, they all go off together. So, Prahlad's point is this taste, this flavor that they're seeking, that's what the cats are getting in the street. That's what the dogs are getting in the street. It takes a brave person to think like that. I know, I know. I know you're not going to do this. You're not going to look at some cats or dogs cohabiting in the street and say, they're getting the same flavor that we're getting. It'll be too revolting for you, even though it's true. It's just too much of a blow to the ego. Ah, it's got to be something more. We've got art. We've got science. No, Prahlad Raj says the flavor is the same. It takes a brave person to see this. He's not talking about the package. He's not talking about the circumstance. He's talking about the actual flavor, the juice that you taste this activity. And then the other thing is the happiness and distress already decided for this life. Why struggle for it? You're going to get what you're supposed to get. Why don't you try to shape the future so that you get free from karma? Because there is something much better to have than material happiness and distress. That is Prahlad's point. Not that you just lay back and say, everything is great this day. No need to do anything. Let's let it all happen. No, that is not his point. His point is that you've got better things to do than struggle for things that are predestined. What is not predestined is your spiritual achievement. Why not endeavor that way? Endeavor for the real happiness beyond the clutches of time. That way you don't have to play beat the clock anymore. We always feel like we're fighting time. A certain amount of time in my life, got to achieve certain things. We're always struggling to maintain certain flavors, which automatically become spoiled by time. Everyone's had that feeling that you really liked someone at some time, but then time just took things a different way. And the thrill is gone. That's time. Time has defeated you. Time has corroded the freshness that you were so attracted to. So, Prahlad, at 5 years old, is pointing out that there's a superior happiness that is not affected by time. It's not affected by your past karma reactions. That's what you should be trying for. That is unique. No animal can get that. This gift requires the higher developed consciousness of the human being. So, in a nutshell, what is the nature of that happiness that Prahlad is directing us to? That is the happiness of understanding the source of everything, the original person. Once we understand what is the origin of everything, what is the nature of that origin, then we can truly understand what real happiness is. If we simply become caught up in things that have a beginning and end, the material energy, then we'll miss out on understanding that there's a completely different kind of experience available. So Prahlad, at 5 years old, was leading his schoolmates toward Krishna consciousness. Understand or be conscious of the source of everything, Krishna, the original person. Now we may say, how can a person be the source of everything? This sounds really mythological. But have you ever analyzed your thinking? How can you say that matter is the source of everything? Isn't that very mythological? To empower matter with inconceivable abilities to give rise to life, to give rise to consciousness. Given a certain amount of time and random chance, it will happen. No. At 5 years old, Prahlad knew much better. And the anticipated knowledge of it, it will teach you much better. And the source of everything is personal. Consciousness comes from consciousness. Life comes from life. So when you understand the source of everything, you're understanding the source of all life, the source of all consciousness. That source is not matter. That source is supreme consciousness. Supreme consciousness means supreme person. In order, it takes a person to be conscious, to have consciousness. But that supreme consciousness, Krishna, is not limited. Although personal, Krishna is not limited. All the persons that we know are limited. Therefore, as soon as we hear that the source of everything is personal, we think, that means limitation, because every individual I know is limited. So we have to re-educate ourselves to understand that in the spiritual reality, personhood doesn't automatically mean limitation. Individuality doesn't automatically mean limitation. In the Upanishads, it is stated in Sanskrit, nityo nityanam, chaitanas chaitananam. Out of all the eternal conscious entities, there's one chief, one supreme. Out of all the conscious living entities, there's one chief conscious living entity. So what is the difference between the one and the many? That difference is immediately understood in terms of the one maintaining all the others. In terms of supplying our necessities of life. That's a basic understanding. You can go much deeper and understand the difference between the Supreme One and all the many other individuals by noting that one is unlimited, the others are limited. So when you start to understand the source of everything, you'll know where the source of real happiness is. The basic understanding in spiritual knowledge, given in Srimad Bhagavatam, is that the absolute truth, the supreme absolute truth, is that from which everything is coming from. Everything emanates. So if you find that ultimate source, then you find the source of real happiness. In order to deal with that ultimate source of everything, you have to understand, is that source of everything personal or impersonal? The fact that you are a person, you are individual, even though it's temporary, as far as you can see, that should let you know that in the source of everything, there is personhood, there is individuality. Now we have to try for information about that supreme personhood, that supreme individuality. But that is what Krishna consciousness is. If you have some questions. But just remember, we're the happiest country in the world. Think about that. How can it be the poorest country? It's the happiest. And then, remember, if you dare to think deeper, remember the points made by the five-year-old boy, Prahlad. He heard this wisdom while he was within the womb of his mother. She forgot these things because she was in too much anxiety about her family affairs. But Prahlad, although in the womb, could assimilate all that knowledge. This shows you that transcendental knowledge, Krishna conscious knowledge, can be received despite any kind of material impediments or barriers. So then Prahlad taught that knowledge at the age of 5 to his schoolmates. And he told me, the taste you get from sensuality is the same in any species of life. It's not that the humans get a special flavor. No, they're getting the same flavor that the fish, the pigs, the chickens get. And his second point was, that happiness and distress that comes to you is already decided for this lifetime. You're going to get whatever you're supposed to get. Not one drop more, not one drop less. All you can simply do is experience your past reactions and create for yourself future reactions. That's all. Thank you very much for your attention. I can go on, but I don't want to keep you too long. Which kind would you like to know about? Which kind would you like to know about? Yeah? Yes, there's the kind that Pallad was saying you can get in any species of life. That flavor of the senses coming in contact with the sense objects, you can get in any species of life. Then there is spiritual happiness, Krishna conscious happiness, which is not a material experience. That comes in relationship. What relationship between what? In relationship between the finite individual consciousness and the supreme, unlimited individual consciousness. So it depends what you're pursuing. Pallad's point, the five-year-old boy's point, was don't waste time pursuing material happiness. You're going to get what you're supposed to get anyway, not one drop more, not one drop less. Even if you don't pursue it, it'll come to you in the right amount. And if you do pursue it, you won't get one drop more than you're supposed to get anyway. So better use your energy and time for searching for ultimate happiness. That means beyond the body, beyond the mind. See, animals are emotional. That's becoming more and more recognized. I told you about the tigers. Emotional. You cannot say animals don't have emotions. If you have a cat, you know how cats like to be stroked. They miss the person they're attached to in the household. These are emotions. And then you mentioned the spiritual aspect of such activity. Can you explain that? I wish you could too. I mean, let's just be clinical and analytical. So many people say like that, well, there's a spiritual aspect to it. Fair enough. Please describe it. Fair enough. His physical and his emotional. All right. Now, the question you have to ask yourself is that, is there anything more in life than that? So the body waxes and wanes, it comes and goes. The emotions wax and wane, they come and go. And therefore, it's kind of tricky sailing, isn't it? Navigating these kind of waters that are always shifting, huh? Yeah? Yeah. Sleep at night, that's death. You go to sleep at night, you wake up in the morning and you forget all about your family of the day before. And you make new relations. Oh, you are my new sister. Then you go to sleep again, forget all about her, wake up the next morning. Oh, a new family. Oh. You take birth and die repeatedly. And each time you take birth, you identify with a new set of family members that may not be in a human family. So you say always. Now let's be a bit more precise. What is a good interpersonal relationship? One at a time now, one at a time. Now, Also, bear in mind my disclaimer that I constantly gave to him, which was what? I'm not knocking it. I'm just trying to be analytical. I realize it's a touchy thing, but I always issue the disclaimer. I'm not knocking it. I'm just trying to get precise. Okay? Very good question. There's no proof that there's been a past life, but I can bring you, I can bring up some things that, I understand that, but I can bring up some points that would, yeah. Alright, but first I just want to kind of politely and gently sweep aside your point that, well, you know, there's no proof that we have past life. Okay, fair enough. So, in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives you a universal way to understand. Where is your baby body? It's gone. Where is your teenage body? It's gone. In spite of all those bodily changes, your basic core abstract identity is the same, although the body is always changing. So this gives you a very good indication that even in spite of birth and death, your core identity remains the same. Because in this life, based on what you can see right now, you see bodily change all the time, and yet your core identity is the same. It used to be that most people, not most people, a real Sharpie at this point, would interject, but not everything in the body changes, not all the cells in the body change, the brain cells don't change. But in the past few years, that's gone out the window. Scientists now admit, only recently though, in the past 5 years or so, that every cell in the body changes, even the brain cells. It used to be, up until 5 years ago, the idea was that the brain cells you have when you're 9 years old, or pretty much that's the way it's going to be the rest of your life. But no, just as Lord Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, every cell in your body is changing. So that means you constantly are getting a new body, yet your basic core abstract identity remains the same. So that gives you powerful reason to understand that perhaps that I survive all the bodily changes, even the changes of birth and death. Then if you want to deal with the latest scientific information, there's an extraordinarily prominent researcher in the USA, Ian Stevenson, who has done case studies all over the world of children who are 3 and 4 years old, who start spontaneously remembering their past life. So he sends out these researchers and they hear from the child, and then they go investigate based on what the child said, and they find the former neighborhood of the child, and indeed they find out that someone died in that neighborhood just like what the child described. This is all documented. There are like enormous volumes of this. So much evidence that the AMA, the American Medical Association, that's the doctor's monopoly in the USA, they said, we cannot refute this. The evidence is so impressive, we don't know what to say. But you can go find that. Yeah. And he's done another kind of research about past life also, based on persons with birthmarks. Children with birthmarks that correspond to the way they said they died in a previous life. So then he sends his researchers, and they find that indeed someone died in that kind of way with a gunshot wound here. And then the child is born with a birthmark in that spot. So then they get mathematicians and they calculate the odds that this could all happen by chance, and it comes out to be practically impossible by chance. So all the photographs, all the information are there, volume after volume, like 2,000 cases. He says he can't keep up with all the research work. And this is, no one is disputing. All the, even the skeptics just say, very impressive, and we cannot fault his research. what can we say? So I would say the best indication has been given by Lord Krishna Bhagavad Gita, that just as the child has a future, the teenager has a future, the adult has a future, the old man has a future, similarly someone who's died has a future. No, I'm not talking about belief. I'm just talking about how you are different than the body. And until we understand that, there's no ability to understand anything further. Whether you stamp yourself as a this or a that or whatever, something about you doesn't change, although the body is changing. That is the first point. The first, we start with point one, then we go to point two. Now, point two. Once you understand you're not the body, and that you have a different type of identity, then you have to find out spiritual techniques. Because by acting as if you're the body, it'll become very frustrating. It's just like trying to satisfy your clothes. You change garments, similarly you change bodies. You can't spend your whole life trying to satisfy the garments, similarly you can't spend your whole life trying to satisfy the body. You have to adopt spiritual techniques. Now, spiritual techniques should be able to give you that experience, at least that you're not the body. That's actually not a big key. But once you get the experience that you're not the body, then actually you're going to start to wonder. My body is in relation to society, to family, but what is my spiritual identity in relation? This is where Krishna consciousness becomes the most precious thing. Simply to understand you're not the body is actually not a big deal. Simply to understand you have a spirit and soul is not a big deal. But what is your spiritual identity exist in relation to? That's the big deal. Understanding what is the ultimate source of everything and your relationship with that source. So, for that purpose, for understanding and experiencing your relationship with the ultimate source of everything in its most comprehensive experience, that we recommend. We don't say other ways are wrong, but we just say if you want the most profound and comprehensive experience, the nature of the ultimate source of everything, that's what you should do. But if you understand you're not the body, you are spiritual something other. That's not such a great breakthrough. Although in today's materialistic world, if you can see it's very extraordinary. That's only chapter 2 in Bhagavad Gita. And Bhagavad Gita has 18 chapters. The real goal of life is to use your developed human consciousness to understand your relationship with the ultimate source of everything, and whether that ultimate source is personal or impersonal. Bhagavad Gita, Gita means song, Bhagavad means of the opulent one, the most opulent one, presents to you the source of everything as supreme individuality, supreme personality. Now, how to verify that? Is it just a question of belief? You know, I believe this. What do you believe? How do you believe that? Oh, there you go. No. we need actual methods for verifying. So in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna gives the laboratory techniques for verifying everything he says. Those who are interested in the rare gems, they'll do the necessary to obtain such gems. But not everybody's interested in the rarest gems. So, very nice questions. Anyone else? All right, we're going to do a bit of mantra meditation. Thank you very much for your attention and your very wonderful and penetrating questions. Thank you all very much.